This is an interview with Arthur Hovey, being done on January 8, 1987. We're talking in the oral history office. I'm Laura Smale, doing the interview for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives. And this is an interview which is going to be part of the merger series. I have there's some background on you, and we're really going to start at 1970, but maybe you might just say a little bit about your, I know you were born in Chicago, but
right.
A little bit about your background.
Well, my family is from Stoughton. I was born and raised in Chicago, except for a few years where I lived in Sioux City, Iowa. But most of my education was in Chicago public schools, starting from third grade on. I used to spend my summers in Stoughton, and as a result, became very attracted to the university at that time. So by the time I was a sophomore in high school, I was convinced that I wanted to come to the university as a student. And I arrived here in the fall of 1952.
What did your father do?
My father was an industrial engineer with Armour and Company. He was a graduate of St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota.
So you were obviously going somewhere to college.
Yeah, I don't think there was ever any doubt. That was an interesting time because it was still a time when a small percentage, relatively small percentage of the 18-year-old population went on to college. I'd say roughly 10 to 15% perhaps. It was also a time when you didn't have many options, because if you didn't go to college, you got drafted. That was when the Korean War was on, and the draft was in effect. And so when I came to college, ROTC was mandatory at that time for 2 years. And college students had deferments. And I did eventually enroll in the ROTC program and received a commission after I graduated and served in the military for 2 years. So I've been at the university since 1952, with the exception of the 2 years I spent in the military.
And why had you majored in English, obviously.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Well, I came here originally majored in the first semester I was here, I was majoring in art because I had an interest and a facility for art. But then I didn't see where that was going to take me much. And I remember reading something in the Forsyth Saga, which was a required text at that time in one of the courses I was taking, about somebody naturally going to be a writer as a result of certain experiences, and I felt that if I wasn't going to be an artist, I wanted to be a writer. And so at that particular time, I was interested in studying literature as opposed to journalism. I just never really thought of journalism that much because I wanted to be a novelist or a short story writer as opposed to a journalist, although subsequently virtually all of my professional orientation has been towards being a journalist of one stripe or another.
And you came back to graduate school?
I came back and started working with the Alumni Association in 1959. It took me a while to get a job after I got out of the service because I wanted to settle down in Madison. But there weren't very many opportunities then, as there are now, for someone, and I just banged around for a while and collected my unemployment that was due from the military and was living with my aunts in Stoughton. And this is an interesting sidelight in terms of how things happen to people. I just happened to get a job with an advertising agency here in town, Ralph Timmons Advertising Agency, and I think the reason I got the job there was because maybe I was more awake than anybody who had walked in their door for a while, and I was willing to work for virtually nothing. And so I got a job as a copywriter there, and I worked there for about 6 months. But while I was there, Ralph Timmons, who was the head of the agency, happened to be on the Alumni Association Board of Directors, and the editor of the alumni magazine, George Richard, at that time was leaving for another opportunity, and so they kind of sent word around that this job was open, and Ralph encouraged me to apply for it, and I did, and John Burgee, who was the director of the Alumni Association, found out two things. One, that I was Norwegian, and two, that I was from Stoughton. And Phil Falk, who was the superintendent of Madison Schools at that time, was Norwegian and happened to be from Stoughton. And so Burgee made all of these connections and figured that if I had those two things going for me, I wasn't too bad. So I seemed to be a promising candidate, and then I interviewed and got that job, and got it for three reasons that time. One is, I say, because my ethnic heritage, and two, because I was from Stoughton, and three, once again, because I was willing to work for nothing. So I started at the Alumni Association in the fall of 1959 and worked there for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I went to work for the Harrington administration, which by that time had moved into Van Hise from Bascom.
And that was largely to do with publications and writing too, right? Because
eventually
you were under Bob Taylor.
Right. I moved from, for 8 years I was editor of the Alumni Magazine, then I went up to what was called then Central Administration of the old University of Wisconsin. And I did a lot of writing and editing and special projects and so forth. And I did that for 2 years. And then in 1970, when Ed Young moved over to the chancellorship of the, what we call Madison campus that time, he needed some help around the office. And so I was detailed over there temporarily to help him out, and then one thing led to another, and I just stayed on permanently in that office.
What kind of help did he need?
He just needed a gopher, really. Somebody to answer the mail, help him with speeches, and just be around. Shortly after I got over there, everything started to really heat up. There had been some demonstrations on the campus previously, and the pitch was still quite intense. And so that spring, that is the spring of 1970, was one of the more active times in terms of both intensity and frequency. We went from a GE demonstration, this was an anti-recruitment thing, in early February, which featured a lot of marching around and breaking of windows and so forth. We went from that into the intensity that began to build with regard to the Teaching Assistants Association strike, which finally materialized on the 1st of April of that spring. And then that lasted for a month, and then right after that, we were right into the Kent State Cambodia incursion situation. And then that summer, we had the Sterling Hall bombing.
Yeah.
So that was a fairly loaded calendar, yeah.
And when you, so when you started to work, or when you knew it was going to be permanent, there wasn't any narrow definition of what you were going to
do? No, I think this is something that one has to understand about the administration as I've known it within the university, both prior to merger and since, and when I say university, I mean Madison, is that if you look at the chancellor's office, we have some people who have very definite assignments based on their professional background and so forth, whether it be personnel or budget, facilities. But we also have a fair number of people who are switch hitters and can get involved in a lot of different projects. And I think this has been an extremely creative way to respond to problems, and so that invariably there have been three or four of us around there who have been available for assignments as they come up. Plus, we have our own special professional areas. Mine is the public information area, mm-hmm. and for a number of years now, I've been also the head of the University News and Publications, which we now call Office of Public Information. So we do carry with us a specialty, but we also have these general skills. And we sort of complement each other. I mean, there isn't this territorial struggle all the time that it's sort of whose turn is it with regard to handling any special problems. Mm-hmm. And we work very closely together so that if somebody is away or ill, one or the other of us can kind of step in and continue the process.
So you have to like each other.
Yes, and we do.
Serena Pondrum was around when you started, wasn't she?
Yes. Serena came on shortly after I was there, and once again, this was a case of her being brought in to ostensibly meet a particular need at that time, which was the affirmative action area, which was, we go through these cycles as to what kind of activity is most pressing at any particular moment, and that was when this whole affirmative action thrust from the federal government was really intense, and we had to have somebody there to respond to it. And Serena was a very bright and aggressive person, and she was brought in and started moving very rapidly in that area.
Well, I just understood that she just created dissension and, I don't know, about chaos up in the chancellor's office, and that she, there seemed to be varying opinions as to how effective she was in her job.
Well, I think here is a case of someone being intensely bright. She was a very bright person. And inordinately ambitious, and also doing things that others were not willing to do for one reason or another. So she was able, excuse me, in the course of her activities to stake out an area which was new and very topical and was something that provided power to whoever was in the role of administering the program, because this is where there was a lot of attention at that particular moment. So she moved very rapidly to establish not only herself, but an administrative presence at the campus level. And in doing so, tended to alienate a number of people because the general tone over the years has been a collegial one and a sharing of responsibilities and confidences and trusts. And one begins to accrue power in a sort of natural way over a period of time rather than in a sort of assertive way. And so if you look at the people in the university previously who had been very influential at the campus level, they got that way not overnight, but over a period of time as they built trust and confidence, and they just simply began to do things because that people would give them things to do and they'd just hold on to it. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to note in this context that what we were going towards was an extremely complex administrative structure, whereas previously we had these little areas that were fairly well defined and had specific tasks. If you take the secretary of the faculty's office, the registrar, the bursar, things like that, these were all day-to-day functions which didn't have much ambiguity about them and were not influenced too much by what was happening outside the campus. Whereas if you look at what began to happen in the 1960s, a lot of what we did internally was influenced by what was happening externally. Mm-hmm. In other words, our agenda was not being set by us, it was being set by outside events.
Yeah.
Particularly with the rise of the multiversity. And with funds available in Washington, the way they were, this is a sort of post-Sputnik response, people then began to establish an internal dynamic on the basis of their ability to secure funds from an external source. And then that sort of dictated the way your program was going. Also, there were these public events focused on the war and the social changes that were taking place, which brought pressure to bear on the institution. And so if we staffed up in any particular area, it was in response to either social change or technological change. I mentioned earlier the kind of cyclical things that one goes through. Well, at the beginning of this change, one of the hot areas was computers. So if you knew something about computers, you had a lot of power. Well, that sort of went by the wayside as we began to institutionalize that and the technology began to get simpler so other people could understand it rather than the shamans, if you will, of numerical analysis. That's what we first called it. It was, instead of computer sciences, it was numerical analysis. Then the next wave was the social action, affirmative action type things, plus the crisis management. Then the next wave was lawyers, and all the lawyers came along because we had all these federal regulations that had been set up in the meantime, and we got to be a very litigious society, and so we immediately had to go out and hire lawyers.
When did that start?
That starts in about the mid-70s, early 70s. At one time, the only lawyer we had was Chuck Stathis, and his primary emphasis was on real estate transactions or corporate matters, trusts, and so forth. And then all of a sudden we get lawyers who have to interpret all these federal regulations, and we get into things such as the TA strike, which meant you had to have labor expertise, and then we were into the area of discipline and so forth. The real, excuse me, watershed here was the what happened following the Dow riots of 1967. After that, as you may recall, the Attorney General's office had a hearing, Attorney General Warren at that time, had a hearing on this process because there were several lawsuits that were brought as a result of some of the arrests that were made. And one of the problems that we had was that we had no established set of rules which governed how we would discipline somebody or what was expected of somebody in terms of their behavior on campus at any particular moment. This came, as I say, out of a bunch of hearings that were held, I believe, in the winter of 1968, it would be. And we then codified these into the administrative code, and much of this is the student discipline section, which appeared in there, and the laws on conduct in university buildings and on university lands and so forth. So all of that really demonstrated that if the university, as a public institution, was going to do certain things, it had to do it in the context of a solid legal framework. Plus, at that time, there were a lot of the federal agencies that were growing, too. There were a lot of departments that were established then, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, National Oceanographic Administration, and so forth and so on. There are a whole bunch of new buildings in Washington that are the product of that time. And so we got into administering government contracts. We also got into a much more protective situation with regard to employees. I mean, employees in those days, unless you were civil service, had very few rights, and so we developed administrative provisions which protected our academic staff and our faculty, and things were demanded of them. All of this indicates what you need then is someone to move into an area that had heretofore been uncharted, so to speak, as far as any administrative presence is concerned. And this is where Serena comes into the picture. Yeah. So you then begin administratively to accrue power as you become more indispensable for a particular high visibility part of the university's program. And that's exactly what she did.
And she kind of horned in on the vice chancellor's territory, as I understand it, James.
Yes, and I think this is it's an interesting development, because when Shane first became vice chancellor, he had not only academic affairs, but he had virtually the whole campus operation under his wing, which included housing and physical plant and the personnel operation. And so he was really running everything on the campus. Now, gradually, he began to lose that personnel part of the operation, at least the non-academic part of it. Mm-hmm. He still retained the academic appointment.
The faculty.
Part.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this eventually led to a showdown between Serena and Irv. And Irv Shane expressed his concern to Ed Young in at least two private meetings that they held, sort of heart-to-heart talks. And Irv expressed to Ed at the time his concern over the encroachments that were being made by Serena. And Ed expressed sympathy but did nothing about it. Mm. To the point where Irv decided that he had to, he simply was in an untenable position and he had to leave. Mm. Okay.
We're recording.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. What do you want me to respond to next?
Just the loss of Irv Shane. What?
Well, it was a loss, a quite substantial loss, because it created a vacuum in terms of the overall administration of the campus. Ed Young really had entrusted to Irv the day-to-day administration of the university. And in my experience up to this point, the university was best administered when we had Ed Young as chancellor and Irv Shane as vice chancellor, because Ed took care of most of the external concerns and was very skillful in responding to the crises that we had virtually every other day. I mean, in those days, when we came to work, our sole hope was to make it through the day, literally. That's how intense it was.
So you're not talking all the way up to 74, are you? I mean, isn't that's when Shane left in 75, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, I'm saying in the four Even years, basically, from 70 to 74, and things began to change a little bit.
It was that bad still, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Huh. Yeah, it was fairly intense. You see, we went through periodic disruptions, and there were always there was always a time when, if you had the right issue, you could galvanize 200 people as a nucleus, and they could then attract another 800. So at any given moment, you could expect 1,000 people to be on the streets or in auditoriums or what have you, if the issue was right. And that didn't change for a number of years. Now, what was happening in the meantime was that Ed was taking care of the crisis management and our relations with our many constituents, and Irv was running the campus on a day-to-day basis in terms of its custodial functions, the budget, working with the deans on the academic program, all of those things related to the day-to-day management. Mm. That, as I think I said earlier, began to be affected when Serena came into the picture. And there was a certain divisiveness that began to build up, to the point where Irv felt professionally that his position was being compromised and he had to leave. And he had a an opportunity to do essentially what he was doing at his alma mater, and he left and took that job at Washington.
Turn the tape.
I don't know where we left off, but let's pick up here. I think in order to understand how Ed Young reacted to people, you have to know that Ed was very loyal to those people who he felt had made a sacrifice in his name. And from time to time, he would put people in difficult positions. And if they performed and did something which he recognized as above and beyond the call of duty in his name and protecting him in some way or another, that meant in essence, that they had a lifetime commitment from him to make sure that as best as he could influence within the institution, they would be taken care of. And he felt that with regard to Serena, that she had taken on something that no one else had done. And she'd done it willingly, and she had taken a lot of flack for it, and had really put her body on the line, as we say, for him. And he was eternally grateful to her for that. And so therefore she had a special influence with him as a result of her willingness to do this at that particular time. There were other people he felt the same way about. Ralph Hansen was one. Dave Hansen was another, Dave being our chief legal person at that time. Ralph Hansen, of course, being our police chief, who had an extraordinary skill when it came to dealing with intense crowd situations. Ralph really is without peer, I think, in these kinds of situations where you have a large number of people in a very volatile situation. He has a way of controlling things and diffusing them. So there were a number of people who Ed, over the years, felt an intense loyalty to. So Ed was one who was very loyal to those people who had served him one way or another. Now, I think this has to be understood in the context of a whole generation of people who grew up together at this university. And this happened after World War II, when a lot of people came back and finished up their schooling here, either at the undergrad or graduate level. They were all essentially of the same age. They lived in the same area. And you know those kind of friendships that you form when everybody else is in a sort of the same boat. They become then probably the most enduring friendships that you have for the rest of your life, because of knowing somebody when they weren't somebody. And the reason you know them is because they're individuals and not because of who they are. So there was this group of people that grew up together at that time. And Ed Young was there, and Bri Curl, and Fred Harrington, and Jim Watrous, and Jim Early, who later went to University of California, Santa Barbara, I believe, or one of those, San Diego, someplace like that. The wife is Emily Early, who remained here. He was divorced, but Emily stayed on and worked for years for the Environmental Studies program. The Bradleys, Catherine Bradley and her husband Joe, Leon Epstein, David Fellman, Dave Johnson, later became Dean of International Studies, Scott Cutlip, Bob and Fan Taylor, a whole group of people who formed this alliance. And they, as I say, they grew up together, and they maintained their loyalty to each other all through their professional careers. So if you want to understand how the university worked from probably 1950 to about 1980, you have to recognize this whole generation of people. And Ed was a very key figure in that whole group.
That's very interesting. Does Bill Sewell belong in that group too?
Yeah, right.
I'm just, because most of the people you've mentioned, well, not all of them. No, they weren't all students here. Some of course, Ed wasn't.
Yeah, some are faculty members,
yes,
too.
So it's really as starting as young faculty members.
Yeah, right. Some were grad students who then stayed on as faculty members. Mm-hmm.
I was also thinking they were all of a liberal slap, but I'm not sure that's true of Feldman.
I think he's changed his orientation. He's still very liberal. I think he's institutionally conservative, but politically.
Oh, liberal. I see. Okay. I think I missed
it. Yeah.
Conservative, but that would be institutionally.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, that, and one thinks of that as kind of, the Golden Age is the E.B. Fred group, but this is somewhat akin to it. I mean, there are people who speak of the Golden Age, but they're talking of the Fred and Ingram and Baldwin.
Yeah,
I think, generation.
The interesting transition here, and you can see it in terms of the type of mind at work here. If you look at the speeches of someone like Van Hise, Celery, Burge to a certain extent, and then bring that forward to people like Mark Ingram and Ira Baldwin, you get this tremendous sense of worldliness about them, as though they really encompass the world in their thinking. They're not just absorbed in a day-to-day administration of the institution. And this is another change that begins to take place. These people were, I think, genuine intellectuals. As we get closer to the present day, the type of administrator you get is someone who has had faculty experience and established a reasonable name for themselves, but their approach to administration is one of expediency and political concern more than it is some sort of overriding sense of mission for the institution. And I don't say that's a fault of the individual so much as it is simply a reflection of what happens in terms of the growth of these institutions and the exposures that they have to outside and the types of problems that come forward. If you go, as we did, from George Clark Celery to Mark Ingram to Ed Young, in terms of the Dean of Letters and Science, you can see this progression. There's a marked difference between, no pun intended, between Ingram and Ed Young in terms of the intellectual focus of their thinking. I remember one time waiting for the bus at the top of the hill with Mark Ingram and exchanging small talk with him, and I forget how we got on the subject of falling asleep at night and counting sheep and so forth, but I asked him if he ever used that device being a mathematician, and he said, no, whenever I can't get to sleep, I just start performing continuous fractions in my head until I nod off. And a colleague of mine once said of Dean Ingram, if there ever was a personification of mind over matter, he was it. And of course, all one has to do is read some of his speeches and articles and so forth in his books, and you can see that. Now, none of that would come out in a person like Ed Young. It just wouldn't, it's not intrinsic to his nature. And so you you get that change, and even the successive deans, Leon Epstein, Steve Kleene, and Dave Cronin, if you look at Dave Cronin as a dean, he's still a preeminent historian, but he simply has not had enough time to integrate that interest with his being dean. And much of his decision making is on the basis of allocation of resources not on the basis of some sort of overriding intellectual view of the universe. I don't fault Dave for that so much as the change in the environment. But we're kind of getting all over the map here.
I guess we are. One doesn't, just as the people have changed and are less global, one's conversations tend to be. It is worthwhile occasionally to try and look at the scene as a whole. When I mentioned the Golden Age, that was one division that a lot of people have made, but they're always thinking of it's really when the life scientists were in control and everything was nice and fixed and determined. And that certainly is, if there was such a thing, which I don't think there was, has gone.
No, the Golden Age, if you look at it, it's got a lot of built-in contradictions because if you presume it's the administration of Fred Baldwin and A.W. Peterson plus Clark Smith as Secretary of the Regents, we had that time right after the war when you spent 4 years approximately just coping with the numbers of returning students. And we went right from that into the Korean War and the McCarthy era, when supposedly two things were happening. The faculty were so pusillanimous that they would not stand up to Joe McCarthy, and the students were all part of what was called a silent generation. And they were not expressive of any strong moral points of view at that time. And then that's the Eisenhower administration. So I'm not quite sure I understand the term Golden Age if you look at really the substance of what was going on.
Oh, it's a completely mythical concept.
Yeah.
It's just that a number of retired faculty do speak of it, and what they mean is before all this mess started, federal funds and grants and research, it was the comfortable period.
Well, I think it was a factor of scale, too. That,
yes, scale particularly.
The faculty in those days they were part of a club.
Yes,
I think,
they ate at the university club.
So you had this...
Hi.
So there was this sense of community, the academy, if you will, was fairly well defined then. And the university was not, quote unquote, corrupted by a lot of outside influences. And it was a sort of self-centered, self-satisfied universe that you were working in.
Very, yes. You started in on this when you were saying that, speaking of Ed's loyalty to people, and then you talked about the circle that he moved in, and I suppose in part you were making the contrast between Serena Ponderman and some of the other people that he was, that's a different point. But you compared Serena to Ralph Hansen and David Hansen, and what was demanded of them was, certainly Ralph Hansen had to put his body on the line sometimes. But what Serena was doing was, I assume she got great pleasure out of it, and as you say, it was a source of power, why would he feel that he had to be loyal to her?
Well, because we were at that time getting a lot of pressure from the federal government.
I see. And he felt
to respond, to have some sort of affirmative action program. And if you didn't satisfy the federal government, a lot of things could happen to you with regard to grants and they're holding up your programs and so forth. Now, there was another element at that time that, from Ed's perspective, was seen as damaging to the university, and that was the advocates of one special cause or another, and Serena was viewed as neutralizing them so that they would not take over certain aspects of the university.
Are you talking about the affirmative, the women's...
The women's rights people and whatever else came along at that time. And so she was seen as sort of standing in the door, barring them from influencing unduly the course of the university. Now, I'm not sure that that threat was as real as it was imagined by some people. But you develop a certain paranoia as things go on, and in those days, they literally seemed to be coming in through the woodwork. I mean, we had plastic window sets at the office so that if somebody threw a rock at the window, it wouldn't break the window. It would just bounce off this plastic. That's how we were literally under siege for a number of years. There were times when we would have a police officer sitting in our outer office regularly just because of what might happen during the course of a day.
But not from the women.
I'm saying that this is the climate that is established.
Yeah.
And so if you got one problem, you don't want another one.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't mean to compare in a qualitative sense Ralph Hansen and Dave Hansen and Serena. I merely said that these were people that had felt extreme loyalty to.
Well, no, and you've explained why he would have felt.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have realized that he really felt that she'd protected the university from whatever the federal government might have done.
With the federal government and some divisive people on the inside.
And did you all feel that way too? Did you think that she accomplished that?
No. I felt that that was... personally, I felt that the perceived threat was not as great as the actual threat, and that had some of these people been allowed to act out their grievances, that a lot of that would have just sort of vanished or would have been institutionalized.
Well, I meant, though, the federal government threat.
Oh, the federal government, yes.
Did you think she had,
yeah,
she
there's no question about that, that they were... quite assertive and offensive. And the problem is that someone coming in from the outside has certain preconceived notions about how a university runs. And they are very, very far removed from the reality. And so they concoct these schemes about compliance. And they just simply cannot understand why you can't respond. This goes on all the time, whether it be the legislature or some agency, what have you. They can't understand why the university doesn't run like a factory.
Mm-hmm.
And they presume that you can develop a logic, which on paper seems very, very simple, and then impose that logic on the institution in a way which will meet their needs. Now, all of this becomes a sort of case of bean counting. And many of these programs depend on reporting requirements, which have very little to do with the empirical reality of what's going on. And so you get this statistical requirement that's imposed on you. How many people have you talked to? How many people have you hired in this area or that area? How many minority students do you have on campus? All of this presuming that you can structure a program which is going to meet the needs. Let's take minority enrollment, for example. Over the years, our record has not been very good in this particular area. We do not have many minority students on campus if you look at the total proportion of the enrollment. Now, the inclination has been to say that that's your fault, university. It's your fault because you're just not aggressive enough in this area. Where the basic problem really is in the schools and in the society from which these people emerge. And so if the schools do not graduate a sufficient number, high schools do not graduate a sufficient number of minorities, the pool is going to be very small and the competition is going to be enormous. I mean, if you take the inner city of Milwaukee and presume that let's say in any given year there are, just for sake of discussion, 100 minority students. And there are 2,000 universities in the country who have minority requirements. Where is that pool going to go? And they're going to get better deals somewhere or another. And so what can we offer these minority students who many of them, if they have anything on the ball, could go to Harvard or Yale or some other place for a full ride, virtually. So one tends to simplify these problems on the basis of statistics. If you say you don't have enough women faculty, and you don't have enough in the sciences, in biochemistry or bacteriology, well, then you got to go look at how many women are being graduated with PhDs in any given year in bacteriology or biochemistry. And we have very high standards here in those fields. And among those women, how many would be remotely qualified to put themselves into tenure track here? Worst thing you can do is get a lot of these people here just to meet statistical requirements and then bump them out after 6 years or flunk out all these students, minority students. The greatest disservice, it seems to me, you can do to a minority person is to get them here and give them presumptions about what's going to happen to them here and then have them flunk out and then where are they? If you get them here, you got to make sure you graduate them. So all of this ties into that kind of activity that was part of the question at that moment.
So what she did in enforcing standards for affirmative action, was generally felt effective and answered the federal government's requirements. So it was grateful to her.
Right.
And how much did she have to do with Ed on all of this? I mean, did she talk to him very much about it? Or?
Well, she was she spent a lot of time with him on a day-to-day basis. She literally monopolized his time after a certain period in the office. She spent more time with him, to the best of my knowledge, than any other member of the staff. But sometimes up to 2 hours a day, just talking.
Did anybody complain about it?
If they did, I don't think they got much of an audience.
Huh. Yes, that wouldn't make her very popular.
Yeah. No. There are certain things that happen in the course of any administration with regard to who has influence over the chancellor, the president, or the pope, whatever the case may be. And there are certain people who either have an access or gain an access that is unnatural if you take a look at the allocation of the executive's time. And that becomes a matter of personal chemistry and need, whether it be ego need or programmatic need, what have you.
Presumably she talked to him about other things than,
yes.
than I mean, one could assume she was discussing all the affairs of the
yes.
university.
And,
so
and
that would be resented too.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she sounds almost like a Dawn Percy in a way.
I would not compare her with Dawn at all, because I think Dawn had a great deal of personal ambition, but he also had ultimately an understanding and a commitment to what was best to the institution.
Hmm.
And I think in that was never really that apparent with Serena. You see, you can get away with a lot if, in the long run, people tend to believe that what it is you're fighting for, what it is you're doing, is based on your belief that this is ultimately the best thing for the institution. And so people may be resentful, but they will be respectful in that case.
About oral histories is that you can, especially with a tape, with a computer. But in any case, you can. This is tape two of the interview with Art Hovey. Did she? Ed had meetings, presumably, of his staff. Did you go to these?
Ed never really had what amounted to be a staff meeting. Ed had meetings when he had to have meetings. But he was the type of person who would develop a consensus in a way that nobody would quite understand. There were certain crises where you would have to have meetings. And so the people who would be at those meetings would be those who would be most normally involved in the outcome of the particular episode, whatever it might be. He had dean's meetings, mm-hmm. and those were sort of pro forma exercises. But staff meetings as such, no, he didn't have those. But he practiced what is now called management by walking around. Ed would just, he'd walk down the hall, or he'd call somebody up on the other end of the campus, or he'd see somebody and stop him on the street and talk to him about the weather, the latest thing in the newspaper, and before you knew it, he had exactly what he needed to know from you, and you never knew that he had it. And so when we were going through some of these rather intense crises, Ed would just get on the phone and start calling around. And his, I've quoted this many times, his definition of leadership was, I find out which way the crowd's going and then I run real fast to get in front of them. And now that may seem to be somewhat superficial, but it makes a lot of sense, because in his position, a chancellor has to lead by consensus for the most part. And also with his labor background, he recognized that there are times when it's best just to leave problems alone and they'll solve themselves,
they will get
to be so acute that the solution will dictate itself, and all you have to do then is sort of endorse what everybody is feeling. That's statement about the crowd. If you get to the right point, the role of the chancellor is merely to endorse the will of the people. in the modern era.
Yeah. So you think was he an effective chancellor then?
Yes, I think he was extraordinarily effective for his time, because the thing that happened was that there was a real crisis of confidence in the university, and this is what brought Fred Harrington down. Fred Harrington was deposed because people, at least ostensibly, were unhappy with the way he handled the student protests. In other words, they thought that things were just totally out of hand. I think that is a somewhat superficial view of why Fred Harrington was eventually replaced. I think personally that he had overstayed his welcome with the regents, and there was a group of regents who were conservative that wanted to see him replaced, and that they were working hard to do that, and this just gave them an excuse to force the issue. But I think that Fred's days were numbered, because the nature of the board was changing. Mm-hmm. Now, Ed came in and was immediately faced with these enormous campus upheavals, black student strike, the TA strike, Cambodia situation, and Ed called in the National Guard. And this then demonstrated to a lot of people that he was tough, that he was willing to do this. Now, the reason he called in the National Guard was that we had enough police for a while. If you put together all of our mutual aid forces, that is the state troopers, and the campus police, and the Capitol police, and some city police detailed to us. We had enough to sort of hold the fort for a while. But after a while, these people need rest. I mean, you can only pull so many 12-hour shifts every day. And then these people begin to need reinforcements. So we called in the National Guard primarily because we needed more manpower. But symbolically, you see, what that translated into in the public's perception was that we were putting down the riots using the National Guard. And Ed was willing to do that. But he did that on the request of Ralph Hansen, who said, gee, my own people just can't last it out much longer. Their nerves are getting frazzled and they're just getting exhausted. And so we got to a point where we had to call in the guard, and we appealed to the governor, and he acquiesced very readily. It was a time of great dissension and a great upheaval, and Ed, with his labor background, was the right person at that time. And as I said earlier, with Irv running the campus, so to speak, on a day-to-day basis, that was an ideal pairing, because Ed could take care of all of this crisis management. And so what he did was restore a sense of confidence to the people that there was somebody in charge down here, although that's really not Ed's style at all. I mean, he's not a very authoritarian type person. There were a number of times during that period when people who I knew would call me up and say, what's going on? What did Ed Young mean when he said this or that on television last night? And in fact, it got to the point where we instituted, with the cooperation of WHA, a monthly television show, which was called The Chancellor's Report. And this would be Ed Young visiting with faculty people or staff people, talking about a particular part of the university. And then the latter part of the show would be a call-in. Mm. And people would call in from outside. This was a television show now. And ask questions. Now, most of the people that watched that program were our own staff, because they didn't know what was going on a day-to-day basis. And so this then became an important vehicle to communicate with your own people. Well, we developed certain things in that period which now make it more readily possible to communicate with our various constituencies. But I remember sitting in a control booth and taking these questions as they would come in, and I could recognize the voices of many of our staff people on these
When you say staff,
cartridges.
You mean staff in the university, or
university
specifically
staff.
In Bascom?
No, university.
In the university.
Throughout
yeah.
the university.
Yeah.
Because Ed, being somewhat enigmatic as he is, people were having a hard time understanding what it was that he was saying or doing. And of course that was part of his approach. He always wanted people to be unsure, because if they were, then they would be forced to act themselves, and sometimes they would solve the problem before it ever got to him. So that was the kind of technique he used, and I think for the time it was extraordinarily effective. It's like the general who is marvelous in combat, but once the war is over, then some of the problems begin to appear. And so if you look at Ed's administration in system, when he was president of the system, it's quite without substance, I think, because his stated purpose at that time was just to make sure that Madison didn't deteriorate any further from merger.
How did do you have any sense of how much he communicated with Harrington and before Harrington was forced to resign? I mean, what the relations were between them?
Oh, I think they were very, very close. Because of this relationship that they had over a number of years. Now, both Fred and Ed Young were interested in international education, and the two of them were instrumental in establishing this program that we have in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
And they spent a lot of time out there together, going to Indonesia.
I meant specifically, I know that they were close. I meant specifically mm-hmm. about the protest movement. It seems unfair that Harrington should be blamed for the campus unrest as he was, because could he ever have exercised
no,
any authority?
No, well, that of course is one of the he's a tragic figure in that sense. But it's somewhat ironic to me that Fred, who was a historian, was not reading the winds of history very well at that particular moment. And he thought he could, as he had in the past, just sort of tough this one out and be strong and individually. But this was a much more complex situation than that. And I think he became the lightning rod for a lot of unhappiness, which I don't know of anyone in his position who could have really solved those problems. But people tend to take a very simplistic view of that. It's at the time everybody was saying, why don't you just go in and knock a few of those heads and they'll understand.
But they said that of Harrington, but how could he? He wasn't in charge of Madison.
Well, exactly. But you see, the
they saw him
distinction
in charge.
Hadn't been made at that point.
And
he had, of course, had been a very visible figure all through his administration. And the perception of the president of the university being the president of the university at Madison was still very strong. It's something that still goes on with regard to the system vis-a-vis Madison.
Yeah, well, that's... one gets wrapped up in Madison and forgets that while all this was happening, the merger was happening. It's just two entirely different stories, and yet they were going on. And so what I, let's turn to the merger now. And what I would like to know is when it first, when Bascom Hall first became aware that there was any talk of merger and then that it was serious.
Well, I think this goes back to the 1960s.
Oh, no. Well, I'm talking about, I know that, but I mean in 1970 when Lucy said that he, and now he spoke about merger during his campaign, whether anybody in Bascom was aware of that. No, I know, unless you think you have
Well, well, Ed became aware of this.
Excuse me.
I think Ed Young became aware of this early on because he was quite close to Pat Lucy, and he knew this was coming. And I think that he knew that it was something that he politically could not defeat, that it was an inevitability. And so I think his goal really was to make sure as best as possible that we had as much of a say as we could in the legislation that was being drafted. And the way we did this was we had two key people on that merger implementation committee. One was Clara Penniman and the other was Dave Hansen.
Dave Hansen.
Now, Dave Hansen really was one of the key staff people of that committee, and to the best of my knowledge, in concert with Jack Pelosek, put that legislation together. And of course, Clara, being recognized as a public policy person, was very influential too. So I think the feeling was, well, let's see what we can do in terms of getting out of it as best as possible. So we had our own people in on that committee.
How much contact was there between Ed Young and John Weaver as merger was moving towards being accepted?
Well, I think that that was an uneasy alliance at best.
Was it an alliance?
Well, it was a marriage of convenience, I suppose you would say. Now, I never realized this till much later, but Ed Young was very coy about that job, that is the president of the system. And he used to say he never made a habit of accepting jobs that he wasn't offered when people asked him about that. At the time, I didn't think he wanted the job. I didn't realize till much later that he wanted it very badly. And that became evident when Weaver left. And Ed became a candidate and was willing to accept it. And certain things that he said, certain behavior patterns that came to the fore indicated to me that he wanted it much more than he ever revealed at the time that it was first available. But I think the regents then felt that there was really no way they could politically offered to Ed.
So because he thought it was inevitable, that's why there wasn't any effort in the Madison campus to stir up.
No, I think that he didn't want to get himself politically compromised, as John Weaver eventually was. John Weaver spoke out very strongly against merger. And that then burned some bridges behind him, whereas Ed did not. And you got to remember that on the regents at that time was Burt McNamara, who was an old friend of Ed's. And I'm not sure exactly when Burt was president. It might have been shortly after merger. But Ed had two key associations that at the time of merger. One was with Bert McNamara on the Regents, and the other was with Pat Lucy as governor. And Ed and Pat could get together and trade horses with the best of them. So I think that Ed felt, as long as he had those alliances, that we were covered.
Did he? But he must not have liked the idea of merger.
No, I don't think he did, but...
And he couldn't talk Lucy out of it.
Well, it's one of those things, is if you talk him out of it, what do you propose as an alternative? Mm. You've got to then come up with something that is more appealing. And it was a question at that time of the allocation of resources, as it had been growing since the middle 60s, as to who was, were you going to have this constant fight downtown in the legislature of lobbyists from all over the state attacking you, or were you going to focus this in one particular area and say anybody from the university had to come from the system, as opposed to Oshkosh and River Falls and Milwaukee and Madison and everybody trooping downtown to state their case. So the alternative to merger would have been to suggest some other arrangement that would have resolved those questions about what you're going to do with regard to allocation of resources and the growth of academic programs at the various institutions. And there was no counter proposal that was even floated at that time that would have addressed those problems. So I think that's one of the key elements of this whole thing.
Well, how did it manifest itself once it was passed and the system administration was set up?
Well, then we began the implementation of the legislation, and we really did not have what amounted to be a University of Wisconsin system till Bob O'Neill became president. Because what had happened was that in that initial stage, you had John Weaver, who was recruited to be president of the old University of Wisconsin to replace Fred Harrington. And we had a board of regents that was virtually split down the middle between the regents of the old state universities and the regents of the university. And so you had to go through a number of years where the regent mix would change so that you lost at least those vested interests in a community sense that you had, and go then to another more universal pattern. But that never developed, because what happened then is when you got the geographic vested interest replaced, you replaced it with a special interest group type person. So then the regents that became appointed subsequently represented a segment of the state's population which was identified either ideologically or ethnographically. So you got somebody from labor, or you got someone from the minority community, and more these people then, when they became regents, were agents of a particular constituency. And this, of course, became identified when you got what amounted to be a student regent appointed to the board. So really, in those early stages, we just had to go through a period of time which made the transition from the old pattern to the new. Now, the regents prior to that, of the University of Wisconsin at least, when they became regents, they left behind their own ideological baggage to a certain extent and became citizens of the state, if you will. And they saw that their role as regents then was to represent all the people of the state. That's why I think the regents were much more powerful in those days than they perhaps are now, is because the board was recognized as not just a group of special interest types, but as leading citizens of the state. And if you were going to tangle with them politically, you had a lot of influence to deal with, because these people could marshal a lot of influence, and they were highly respected. When I first came to work for the Alumni Association, for example, we had people like Oscar Rennebaum, Charles Gillette, Harold Connick, Robert Bassett, Wilbur Rink, who were regents and who were recognized as outstanding people throughout the state. I mean, they were state figures as well as just regents. And so they engendered an enormous amount of respect from that standpoint. And then later we got Arthur de Bartleben, Kenneth Greenquist, and so forth.
So you think that in the 1970s, the regents, I know that they were divided between the WSU and UW boards. I do have the impression, I've been reading through regents' minutes, that on the whole, they were aware of Madison's position, and that on the whole, Madison made out reasonably well and with the regents. Is that right or not?
Yes, I don't have the same view as some of my colleagues do about a merger being a disaster as far as Madison is concerned. I think a lot of things that we suffered because of what was happening in the country. Rather than merger. And some of that has to do with the comments I made earlier about the sort of simplistic approach to administering higher education, and some of that goes to the formulaic approach to this or that, that you presume you can put together a formula which will then dictate what's going to happen. Or how you analyze, how you gather management information. I do think that there were some serious problems that developed with regard to the allocation of resources to Madison. And there's no question that we did not get our proportionate share. And of course, this flared up again when we had the debate over the faculty catch-up.
Now, is that due to the regents or to the
system? I think it's the system staff, because whenever you get a system like this, there's a certain democracy that one has to observe, and one simply has to spread out resources to make it look as though you're not favoring one over the other. Well, that, of course, is the inherent flaw of any merged system, is that water seeks the lowest possible level. And so if you talk about a common denominator, it's the tendency is to go towards mediocrity. And there's very little room for meritocracy in the process. Because we get this constant talk of elitism, and Madison is resented throughout the state because we are seen as a bunch of elitist and people think that we're arrogant and so forth.
Well, that's in the press, but the system, you feel, reflected that.
Oh, yeah, I think that the faculty are very resentful at other institutions. That is the more venal ones.
Oh, yes, but I'm at the system administration.
Well, I think the system administration is always in a box, like any administrator, is that you have to allocate resources to keep people reasonably happy and to recognize their needs as much as possible. Now, one of the precepts of merger was that you would develop centers of excellence, and each institution would develop that specialty for which it was known. Well, that went by the boards fairly rapidly. And so there are some strong programs here and there, but if you take, for example, the forestry program at Stevens Point, which gets a lot of publicity in our forestry program, from an academic intrinsic standpoint, in terms of the actual quality of the program, there's just no comparison. I mean, our people here are head and shoulders above the people there.
Yeah.
That is the faculty.
If the press measure, would always talk about Stevens Point.
Yeah,